This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson in Washington. On October 20th, 2014, a teenager named Laquan McDonald was shot dead by a Chicago police officer. McDonald was shot at 16 times as he was moving away from police vehicles. Video of his death would go unseen by the public for more than a year, and when the footage did come out, it sparked protests across Chicago. The officer, Jason Van Dyke, was charged with first-degree murder that day. Last week, a jury convicted Van Dyke of second-degree murder and 16 counts of aggravated battery with a firearm.
We, the jury, find the defendant, Jason Van Dyke, guilty of aggravated battery with a firearm, first shot. We, the jury, find the defendant, Jason Van Dyke, guilty of aggravated battery with a firearm, second shot. We, the jury, find the defendant, Jason Van Dyke, guilty of aggravated battery with a firearm, third shot.
One battery count for each bullet. The conviction surprised many people. Van Dyke is the first Chicago police officer in 50 years to be found guilty of murder. The verdict led some to wonder if this marks a new period of accountability for police officers and police departments. Is change on the horizon? And what does this verdict mean for police reform around the country? Joining us from WBEZ, Chicago Public Media, is its criminal justice reporter, Patrick Smith. He's covered the Laquan McDonald case since the beginning, and he is also heard in WBEZ's podcast on the case called 16 Shots. Patrick, welcome to 1A.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us is Judge LaDoris Cordell. She is retired from California's Superior Court system and is the former independent police auditor in San Jose, California. Judge Cordell, welcome.
Good to be here.
Also with us from WYPR Public Radio in Baltimore, Neil Franklin is a retired major from the Maryland State Police Department. Currently, he's the executive director of LEAP, Law Enforcement Against Prohibition. It's a nonprofit focused on improving relations between police and the public. Neil, glad to have you with us.
Thank you, Joshua.
We're also glad to include your questions and thoughts about improving law enforcement, whether you are a law enforcement officer, an activist working for reform, or just a citizen in a community that's dealing with this issue. What's the conversation like where you live, and what are you seeing that works or does not work in rebuilding trust? Email us, 1A@WAMU.org, comment on our Facebook page, or tweet us at 1A. Patrick Smith, let me start with you. Give us a quick overview of who Laquan McDonald and Officer Van Dyke were, particularly Officer Van Dyke and what his record was like within the police department before all of this happened.
Well, Laquan McDonald was a 17-year-old. He had a difficult life before this shooting. He was in the foster care here in Chicago, foster care system. He was sort of in and out of juvenile jail, but his friends describe him as a fun-loving guy who was you know, always sort of cracking jokes. And, you know, even though he was in the foster care system, he was mostly placed with family. He grew up with his grandmother. Officer Van Dyke, he joined the Chicago Police Department in 2001. We got a chance to interview him before the trial started with our partners at the Tribune. And you know, he said he believed he was a good officer. He joined the force because he wanted to help people. However, in his years on the force, he racked up, you know, more than 20 citizen complaints against him. Most of those were not found to be true by the Chicago Police Department. However, they side with the officer in most of the cases. And we heard from experts who said that sheer number of citizen complaints should have been a red flag to the department.
Patrick, what exactly happened on the night that Laquan McDonald was killed?
Well, so there was a call in that someone was in a truck yard trying to steal radios. A couple officers, not Officer Van Dyke, responded to the scene, and pretty soon after they called for help, they called for a taser specifically. They said that Laquan McDonald was walking away from them with a knife in his hand. That sort of slow speed foot chase where Laquan was just sort of walking and the officers were following behind him at a slow speed went on for about 10 minutes. When Officer Van Dyke and his partner got on the scene, they were on the scene for less than 30 seconds when Officer Van Dyke got out of his car, and within 6 seconds he started shooting. He unloaded his gun into Laquan McDonald, and he hit him all 16 times.
Curtis tweeted, "It absolutely must be pointed out that Chicago sat on the video for a year and only released it after a court order. Van Dyke was only arrested after Chicago was forced to release the video." Patrick, why did it take so long for this video of the incident to come out?
Well, that really depends who you ask. You know, the official, what city officials say is that the policy from, you know, since forever has been that when there are investigations going on, you don't release evidence. And this video was evidence in, they say, an investigation both by the city to see if any you know, police rules were broken, and also by the state's attorney's office to see if they were going to file criminal charges. I think there are many, many people in Chicago who don't quite buy that, who believe that this video was kept under wraps because it looks really bad. You know, the city paid Laquan McDonald's family $5 million without a lawsuit ever being filed, which is not, you know, that's not the only time that's happened, but it is rare. And part of the agreement was that the video would not be released, at least while these investigations were going on.
Neil Franklin, let me come to you. The matter of kind of the code of silence that many civilians perceive in law enforcement is definitely front and center here. As was mentioned by Patrick, Officer Van Dyke had a number of complaints against him. How often do you see it? Just taking a little bit of a step back from Chicago more broadly, how often do you see it that officers with controversial records, with complaints about excessive use of force, find themselves protected by their colleagues, particularly protected from accountability for their actions?
Well, it's quite often. This is part of the culture that needs to be changed nationwide. You know, police officers, especially today, feel that they're out there by themselves and that most of the public has sided against them, which is not true, by the way. So they form a very tightly close-knit circle of protection among themselves. And it usually takes quite a bit for officers to come together for the most part, move someone out.
I'm sorry, Neil, would you just elaborate on that idea in terms of being in it by themselves? What do you mean by that?
So if you know, video has exposed the ugly underside of policing today. What I mean by that, if you go on YouTube today, you can see a number of cases involving excessive force, the lack of transparency, how police officers negatively interact with citizens. They curse at them, they disrespect them, they use excessive force, whether it involves, you know, deadly force or other means. They overreact. And now with the, you know, with everyone literally has a video camera in the palm of their hands. We have body cams, we have in-car cams, and these videos are surfacing one after another. And we're really beginning to see what citizens have been complaining about for decades in this country regarding the abuse of certain police officers working in their communities. And this has caused citizens to begin to push back at alarming numbers, the protests that we're seeing across the country. And now police are circling the wagons. And, you know, they're forming this circle of protection. They're behind each other. And they realize that when they're out there working in the streets, and some of these neighborhoods are dangerous, quite dangerous, they realize that, you know, their backup could be the officer that they protected yesterday from some sort of complaint.
Judge,
you know, by siding with them. So there are a number of reasons why, you know, the police have formed this very close-knit culture of protection among themselves, which prevents officers like Van Dyke. Patrick talked about the number of complaints, unsustained complaints that this guy has had. And that is because apparently the evidence has not been there, you know, to sustain these complaints. And what evidence am I talking about? Statements from police officers who may be on his squad or may have witnessed something, because when it comes down to it, when police are investigating their own, they're going to believe the statements and versions of their police officers before mm-hmm. they will believe that of a citizen. And that's why video is so important.
Well, I'm also curious, Judge Cordell, in terms of how far up the chain these efforts to protect officers who use excessive force go. I mean, you had a big job dealing with San Jose Police Department, which, you know, San Jose is the largest city in the San Francisco Bay Area. It's a city of about 1 million people, significantly larger than San Francisco itself. Talk about some of what you saw in that big city in terms of the impediments to getting at the root of bad policing when it shows up.
So it's important, first of all, to understand that when you talk about the police, it's not a monolithic group. There's generally the rank and file, and that refers to the union. And then you have the leadership, the command staff. And really what controls what happens with the police department is really the rank and file. Police unions are very, very powerful in this country. And while the power of other unions in other professions has declined over the last even two decades, the power of police unions has grown. So that I found to be, not just in San Jose, but everywhere, to be the biggest obstacle to getting police departments to be more transparent and to be able to hold police officers accountable. Police departments historically are resistant to any kind of oversight at all. And the attitude pretty much is, look, we have the training, we went through the academy, what right do you civilians have to even say what we're doing is wrong or right? And the result of that is that you have police basically policing themselves. And any kind of institution that polices itself means that they are not being held accountable by those whose lives they're impacting. And any systems that police themselves are ripe for corruption. And that's what tends to happen in law enforcement. Mm-hmm. When you have police departments, however, that are very more open-minded and more receptive to having oversight,
right.
And that became the case in San Jose.
Hold right there, if you would, Judge. We got to pause in just a second. I'm sorry to cut you short, but I do want to get more into that when we continue our conversation. Sit tight for just a moment, if you would, please. I'm Joshua Johnson. You're listening to 1A from WAMU and NPR. This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson. We are discussing the verdict in the Laquan McDonald case. That was the teenager who was shot dead in Chicago by Officer Jason Van Dyke. We'd love to hear from you, whether you're in Chicago or anywhere across the country, with regards to what this means for the effort to improve law enforcement in this country. Comment on our Facebook page, tweet us at 1A, or email 1A@wamu.org. Let me get to a few of your comments before we keep going. Nick is in Wilmington, North Carolina. Nick writes, I'm in North Carolina, and the GOP state supermajority pushed a bill through last year to not release any body cam footage to the public except for family members involved to view. If I could make one law to increase mistrust with the public, this would be the one. B. Sean wrote on our Facebook page, maybe the real issue here is that the criminal justice system in general and law enforcement in particular are being deployed to manage the effects of social and economic problems that they are ill-equipped to resolve. And Seth wrote on our Facebook page, as a white person who works in an office that staffs mostly black people, hearing stories of police shootings scares me that one day I might lose a beloved coworker just because of their skin color. When I found out they found this man guilty, I was elated. It's time for bad cops to stop being protected killers. Judge Cordell, I know I had to cut you short before we pause, but I wonder if we could pick up with Seth's comment and finding Officer Van Dyke guilty. It seems rare that officers are convicted after shooting someone under questionable circumstances. What's the legal reason behind that?
Well, there is a decision from the United States Supreme Court that really is the key to all of this, and that is the decision that the court made many years ago in the Graham case that basically said that when you are determining whether or not an officer is engaged in the use of excessive force, you must basically be in the seat of the officer. So it's a very subjective standard. What would a reasonable officer have done in that situation. So it is not an objective look. It's what is the officer feeling, what is the officer seeing, what is the officer experiencing. So that's what the jurors are required to do. And as a result, you find very few judgments, first of all, you know, in civilly in suing police departments, jurors have to, again, hold the standard. And prosecutors, before they decide to charge an officer, have to look at the standard and say, what would an officer, a reasonable officer in that situation, have done? So it is the Supreme Court that has set this rule for all law enforcement agencies in the country. And there are over 18,000 separate police departments throughout the United States. They all have different rules, but they are all under the umbrella of whatever the Supreme Court set.
Right.
So that is the rule that is out there now.
Yeah, by the way, referring to the case, it's Graham versus Connor. It's a case from 1989. And some of you actually commented with regards to what's going on in officers' minds, like Peter. Peter emailed, "It seems like today, with the mentality of police officers, that their life is paramount beyond all else, including their safety. I feel like whenever they are threatened with any sort of possible harm, they use deadly force, and it is somehow justified. This is a career in which they signed up for, similar to the military, where they know they're going to be put in harm's way to protect and serve. They are paid for this." Let's add one more voice to our conversation before we get to some more of your comments. Joining us now on the line is Shannon Spaulding, a Chicago police officer who was also a whistleblower within the department who worked undercover with the FBI. Shannon, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Joshua.
Now, I understand you had been working as an FBI informant within the department, and as a result of what happened that caused some of your fellow officers not to be too fond with you. What happened that caused such a stir? Did it have to do with corruption inside the Chicago Police Department?
Absolutely, Joshua. I was working as an undercover narcotics officer with the FBI, and I had discovered that some of my fellow officers were actually involved and running the narcotic trade within the Chicago area. And therefore, I began an operation dubbed Operation Brass Tacks against some of my fellow officers who, I use the term officer loosely, because if you are on the other side of the law, you are really not an officer, but they did have badges. And ultimately, that led these officers, one of them being a boss, to go to federal prison. And that made me very unpopular among the ranks and files within the Chicago Police Department, because before I came forward with Operation Brass Tacks, the code of silence was unheard of. You didn't talk about it. It didn't exist. They tried to label me as crazy for believing that this was actually going on within the department. So it made me very unpopular and led to a lot of police retaliation.
I wonder why that is from your perspective. I mean, I can't imagine. I've never been a law enforcement officer. I have law enforcement in my family, but I've never taken an oath. So I can't. I'm speaking as an outsider. But I would think, you know, if I knew that there were reporters who worked for my station who were lying in stories and they got caught, I would be grateful to see them go, because that drags all of us down. Why do you think it's not a similar mentality in law enforcement?
You know, honestly, a lot of police officers did approach me and they still talk to me. And you are correct. Honest police officers absolutely do not want to work alongside with corrupt officers. However, the code of silence is so strong within the Chicago Police Department, and I feel that does go across departments nationwide, that officers actually fear what will happen to them if they break this code of silence. And what was interesting to discover during this journey of breaking the code of silence is that there's this common misconception that it's blue officers, blue shirt, common street officers going against other officers, when actually I learned that the retaliation came from the top down. Bosses were actually instructing the officers who were working with me not to back me up, or they would be the next Shannon Spaulding. So out of fear of becoming me, out of fear of retaliation themselves, or putting their lives in danger, losing their job, what could happen to them? They complied because it's easier. It's mm-hmm. easier than going through everything that I had to go through. And even though officers didn't want to, they felt they had to. I had officers come up to me and say, you know, I believe in what you're doing, but I can't be seen talking to you because I'll be next.
Well, let me play a clip from the president of Chicago's Fraternal Order of Police, Kevin Graham. This is what he had to say after the conviction of Officer Jason Van Dyke. This clip comes from WBEZ's podcast on the Laquan McDonald case called 16 Shots. Here is Kevin Graham.
Look, I do blame some of the politicians. I think that over the last several years, they have used this case, one case, and I want to remind everybody, we answer millions of calls every year, and they have used this case to really kick around the Chicago Police Department, which has been unfortunate, because I am going to tell you this, and the men and women of the Chicago Police Department are some of the finest police officers in this country. They take seriously what they do, and they try and provide the best protection they can for the people of the city of Chicago, and they do it putting their own lives in peril every single day and night.
That's Kevin Graham, the president of Chicago's Fraternal Order of Police. Shannon, I'd love to get your thoughts on what Kevin Graham said. I mean, it doesn't minimize this Laquan McDonald case, at least for me, but I do kind of see what he's getting at in terms of getting a bad rap. I mean, if you want to see a positive portrayal of the Chicago police, you got to watch NBC in primetime. I mean, it just you don't hear much of it. Do you think that Mr. Graham has a point?
Absolutely, he has a point. I do want to say most of the Chicago police officers, men and women, go to work every single day to serve with honor and integrity. And when they do so, they are willing to lay their life down for you. That is the job they signed up for. It is like being in the military. You know you're going into harm's way. What I found out, though, is you expect the dangers to be from the outside world, not from within your own department. It is a shame that officers who are in good standing and serve with integrity now have a tarnished badge that they wear because of the few corrupt. Every profession has some bad apples, and this includes law enforcement across the nation. However, citizens must remember that not every officer is corrupt, and officers must remember not every individual of color is a criminal. There has to be a mutual respect both ways, and I think with the Jason Van Dyke trial, it is over. The verdict is in. We cannot go back and change the mistakes of the past, but we absolutely must learn from them and go forward in a positive direction, regardless of what side of the Laquan McDonald, Jason Van Dyke case you're on.
I think
we can all agree that Chicago needs to move forward in a better direction, and we need to do it together, the police and the citizens, or we won't be able to make a difference.
I should note, by the way, we did reach out to the administration of Chicago's current mayor, Rahm Emanuel, for comment regarding Officer Spaulding's case. It did not respond. WBEZ has reported that the mayor and his administration have denied that there was any retaliatory treatment for Officer Spaulding's actions, but the mayor's office did not respond to us. That invitation is still open. Let me get to a few more of your comments. Jim emailed, "The public should take some comfort from the fact that there were many more officers present when Laquan McDonald was killed, and they acted with proper restraint. Only Jason Van Dyke acted on raw emotion. That said, the institutions, the police unions, the police command structures, the arbitration processes, and the city administration certainly need reform and more transparency." I'm Joshua Johnson. You're listening to 1A. Patrick, let me bring you back in. Here is a clip from the Reverend Martin Hunter. He is the great uncle of the late Laquan McDonald. This is what Reverend Hunter had to say after the verdict against Officer Van Dyke was read.
I can't rejoice in a way you know, to say yippee-yay-o-ki-yay because this man is going to jail. When I looked over and I saw his wife, my mind had to go to his daughters. His wife who didn't pull a trigger, his daughters who didn't pull a trigger, his father, he didn't pull a trigger. I could see the pain in those people, and it was touching my heart to see that pain. But it was also touching, bothering me that they couldn't see the pain that was within us.
That's right. Couldn't see it.
They never really gave their condolences. And everybody that tried to come to us on behalf of Jason Van Dyke, they came to us asking us, could we forgive Jason Van Dyke? And I want the world to know that you can't just go around forgiving people who, number one, didn't think they'd done anything wrong. And who, number two, never asked for forgiveness. Jason Van Dyke has never asked his family for forgiveness, period, at all.
Patrick, I wonder what the conversation has been like in Chicago after the verdict, what the response has been. I have to say, personally, I was surprised to hear Reverend Hunter put some distance between forgiveness and Jason Van Dyke, especially based on what Christian theology says about forgiveness. But I also understand, like, he lost a loved one. How are Chicagoans talking about this, particularly in terms of being able to move forward or even forgive?
Well, I think I haven't heard from a lot of people who are willing or interested in forgiving Officer Van Dyke. I mean, I think it depends on who you're talking to. There are many in Chicago who don't believe that Officer Van Dyke needs to be forgiven, who think that he was put in a tough situation and did what he was forced to do, even after the verdict. They believe that. And there are many others who are glad about this verdict and believe that this is justice being done. I agree with you about, you know, the Christian beliefs in forgiveness. However, as Reverend Hunter said right there, you know, Officer Van Dyke has maintained that he did nothing wrong. Now, obviously, there are legal reasons for that, the why he would maintain that. But it is hard to forgive someone who is not admitting fault or asking for forgiveness. But no, I have heard the Chicagoans that I've talked to who believe that Officer Van Dyke, you know, was guilty. They are gratified by this verdict, and they believe that him spending a long time in prison it would be justice.
Aaron writes, when you read how the Chicago Police Union responded to this conviction, I'd say that there's not much hope for real reform. They believe the conviction was wrong. Evidently, it's okay for the police to murder someone in the course of doing their job. Richard wrote in our inbox, my nephew is a police officer who told me that they have a saying, better to be tried by 12 than be carried by 6. Presumably meaning that it's better to deal with the criminal justice system than to be shot on the job. Neil Franklin, I have to pause in just a minute, but could you speak to this idea of the mentality of officers in this cone of silence? I mean, there are officers who want corruption rooted out. There's also the police union, which has to speak in a larger sense and protect every single officer who is a dues-paying member. How do you see this before we have to break?
Yeah, first, just to comment on what Judge Cordell said about unions and their power. And the other thing she said was about police oversight. And we need community oversight of police departments and move away from police policing the police. That's a whole nother story. As it relates to the mentality and thought process of these officers, I mean, Officer Spaulding hit it right on the head. You know, what she was talking about is absolutely correct. But I want to say something about the officers who would come to her and speak to her and all those officers out there who don't want this type of policing, who don't want the corruption, who don't want the officers like Van Dyke who have these many, many complaints. If they were to come together, their numbers are so much greater. If they were to come together and form a movement to move these officers out of the ranks so they can be the police officers and the departments that they want to be for their citizens, we wouldn't have this, but if they're not capable of doing that, we need community oversight of these police departments. So I just want to push back on that just a little bit, because talking about the few bad apples, you know, the ones who don't come forward like Spaulding did, are they not also problematic in allowing this to occur?
Hey, Neil, I'm sorry. I hate to cut you short. We're going to pick this conversation up on the other side of this break, but I need to get to a little bit of breaking news that has come out since we went to air. We are just learning that Nikki Haley, America's ambassador to the United Nations, is resigning. Ms. Haley is the former governor of South Carolina. She had been an early and frequent critic of President Trump and then joined the administration as the U.S. ambassador to the U.N. According to NPR's diplomatic correspondent Michelle Kellerman, according to Michelle's sources at the State Department, Nikki Haley informed her staff today that she would resign. President Trump has tweeted, quote, "Big announcement with my friend Ambassador Nikki Haley in the Oval Office at 10:30 a.m. unquote. That's right about now. We'll keep an ear and an eye on that. But again, NPR is reporting that Nikki Haley, the U.S. ambassador to the U.N., has resigned. More in a moment. Stay close. A quick heads up about our conversation on tomorrow's program about climate change. The world is talking about a new report by some of the most renowned climate scientists, putting a finer point on just how little time we have to do something about our warming planet. The report states that we have until about the year 2040 before we reach a point of no return. It also gives reason for hope that we have the skills to do something if we work together. We want to answer your questions about what it would practically take to fight climate change. Leave us a voicemail, 855-236-1A1A. We'd also love to know what you're working on to fight climate change in a big way. Tell us your story, 855-236-1A1A. Or you can use our app, 1A Vox Pop, to send us a high-quality audio file and to keep up to date on future topics. You can find 1A Vox Pop, V-O-X-P-O-P, in the App Store. And we'll share some of your questions and stories tomorrow on 1A. Back now to our conversation with Neil Franklin, Shannon Spaulding, Patrick Smith, and Judge Ladoris Cordell. Let's get to some more of your comments before we start kind of looking forward at where the effort to improve policing in America might be going. Hey Sailor tweeted, "The reasonable officer standard is a very easy standard to apply. It's not that hard. We do need to eliminate the criminal justice college major and hire police with degrees in psychology or sociology. Too many cops have no business carrying a badge and a gun." However, Galvin had these questions. Galvin writes, "The question is, what is reasonable? Does disobeying a police officer shouting orders constitute the right to use deadly force? Does a drug dealer running away from the police deserve to be shot? While they may be criminals, are the actions from the police equivalent to the criminal's actions?" Judge Cordell, maybe you should respond to Galvin. How do we suss out, in a finer sense, what reasonableness is?
Reasonableness is in the eye of the beholder. It really has no one definition. And what jurors are required to do is put themselves in the shoes of the officer. What was the officer seeing, experiencing? And oftentimes incidents happen in, you know, just a matter of a few seconds. So there really is not one definition of it. But I do want us to get to something you said, Joshua, about, you know, looking ahead. I believe it's time to reimagine policing in America. Policing in America today is quasi-militaristic, and police departments, officers are seen as an occupying force, especially in communities of color and in low-income communities. That's not how policing started in this country. Policing started with individuals who lived in a community, who knew everyone, and they were people who were not seen as an occupying force. They were people there to basically provide a service and help the individuals in the community. And it has dramatically changed. We have police departments armed to the teeth with tanks and all kinds of equipment that are commonly used in the military. And I think it's time to change this whole thing. We need to start thinking outside the box. Why do we need police officers to basically patrol and take care of traffic issues? Why can't that come from within the community? Why can't individuals, community members, somehow be deputized to deal with those kinds of things, the minor kinds of things that are happening in the community.
Well, in some communities, Judge Cordell, I'm not disagreeing with you, just by way of context, there are some places where a lower level of sworn law enforcement officer does deal with things like parking enforcement and traffic enforcement and things that are less likely to require deadly force.
Sure. But my point is that our whole attitude, and this is even within police departments, they see themselves as this, you know, kind of a militaristic force, and they do have a command structure, and so what I'm saying is that maybe it's time now to say, let's pull back from this whole image we have of police being occupiers and look at a different model entirely. I'm not opposed to criminal justice reform, but look what happened. We get body cameras, and what happens? Well, we have officers, some who, don't turn their cameras on. Or we have places like Chicago where it takes more than a year and a court order to get footage out on, for example, on Laquan shooting. So the whole lack of transparency, policing, for example, has very little sunshine. There's very little sunshine in policing. We don't get to know who these officers are, their track records, their history, their right. discipline history. It's very, very difficult to get that information in most states.
I think that dovetails with a comment that one of our listeners left for us. Reggie, who lives in Maryland, left this in our inbox.
I've talked to police, both black and white, and they seem to have this militaristic approach to the community. I have had experiences where, you know, police just simply, you know, would rather have conflict with the community rather than actually serve it. I really think that they should, you know, take away the guns for the first couple of months, put police 2x2 inside of the community without guns, make them stay in the community to force them to have a dialogue with the community. I think it'll do a lot better with serving the community.
Reggie, thanks for calling in and sharing your thoughts with us. Neil Franklin, I'd love you to respond to that, but if I could first, if we could contrast what Reggie said with another set of comments that we've gotten from some of our listeners, like what Skylar wrote. Skylar writes, police put their lives on the line every day protecting our society. 90% of the cases put forward by activists as examples of police brutality involve people not complying. Why is the outrage not centered around these individuals' behavior that got them shot? If a cop breaks the law, I'll convict them. But if there is any doubt, I'm siding with the police 100% of the time. Neil, what would you say to folks who say that police work is inherently difficult, inherently dangerous, potentially deadly, and that we as a public also have a role to play in easing the tension that officers feel about just being able to make it home at night?
So I believe it was Reggie that left the message.
Yes.
You know, that was such a brilliant comment because forcing the dialogue. See, when you develop a relationship with those people you are serving, the citizens you are serving, and you get their support, your job isn't as dangerous as it is today. It, you know, going back to what Judge Cordell said, how it used to be, having relationships, walking up and down the street, talking with citizens, talking with the neighbors. When something happens, they support you when you have those relationships. But when you have this occupying force where you know none of the people or very few of the people or the ones that you do know, there's conflict on the other end of that relationship, that's a problem. This goes to community control policing that I mentioned before, where the community sets the philosophy, where the community sets the budget for those in uniform, where the community decides who the leader is going to be, whether you call them a chief or commissioner or whatever, where the community decides what's important, where the community decides, you know what, we can handle these issues at the ground level. We just want you to pay attention to people hurting other people, and this is how we want you to do that. But policing is very political. It's political through the unions. It's political through the mayors and the governors. And we'll never get to that place until the community decides. And they come together and say, we want control over our police departments, and this is how we want to do it. Having that oversight at the beginning means that you don't need police review boards at the end when something goes horribly wrong.
Yes. Speaking of which, we got some ideas from some of you about what could be done with regards to policing, and review boards were part of it, including on a larger scale. Jamie asked, shouldn't there be a national group or board who could provide oversight over individual police departments? They could be an objective, trusted advisory board whose judgments both sides would trust and accept, and to whom an aggrieved local citizens group could appeal. Paolo tweeted, police forces with their training transform them from people's defenders into a community's foes. With this stance, the police force is not your friend, even if you are a regular law-abiding citizen. So maybe training's part of it. And Hector emailed, the UK and other European Union countries have unarmed, on-duty police officers, and we should have more unarmed cops, too. Patrick Smith, I'm not sure if anyone is advocating that any officers in Chicago disarm themselves, but I wonder what people are suggesting. I mean, is there a conversation about lasting change after the Laquan McDonald case, or are there still other loose ends with this that need to be tied up first before we talk about reform?
Well, there are. I mean, the video of Laquan McDonald shooting prompted the Department of Justice to come in and investigate the Chicago Police Department, which has been done in other cities. And actually, our state government and the city of Chicago are in the very final moments of sort of hammering out a consent decree to make big changes over the next, you know, decade to the Chicago Police Department. The police union here is very opposed to that effort. They think that this reform is not going to help. It's going to make us less safe. Many activists think this is a really good, you know, a really big step. And then, of course, there are some who are skeptical that this is going to be the change that we really need. And I will say one thing that has been talked about a lot here that some of the comments you've gotten have alluded to is the idea of having officers in neighborhoods that they really know. Something that I've heard from a lot of people is that there are white officers, you know, Chicago is a very segregated city, that there are white officers who really didn't have much interaction with people of color before they joined the force. And then they are sort of dropped first thing for, you know, as soon as they're out of the academy, into some of the toughest neighborhoods in the city where they are encountering and working with people of color. And they don't know what they're, you know, they don't know what they're doing, essentially, and they're overmatched, and sort of cultural differences and blind spots are making the problem worse here. That's something that some people say would help out in the city, to have more representation, have police officers policing in neighborhoods where they themselves live.
I'm Joshua Johnson. You're listening to 1A. Patrick, one more quick question for you. I know we're low on time, but Aaron wrote on our website, the1a.org, I cannot believe the police officer lied the way he did on the stand. It appears to me that they made up a story before they knew the tape evidence existed and stuck with that story, even though the video clearly shows what happened. I wonder what the perspective from the video the police destroyed would have shown. Are the officers who destroyed that evidence going to be tried for that crime? Patrick, what's Aaron referring to here?
Well, the shooting happened by a Burger King, and that Burger King had surveillance footage that would have captured, likely, it seems like where the camera was would have captured the shooting. However, a big chunk of that footage was sort of mysteriously missing from the footage. And the Burger King manager told reporters that police came in and seized it, and he, you know, sort of suspected they destroyed it. I will say that the prosecutors here said that there was no evidence that there was any damage to the surveillance footage, that this was a coincidence.
Before we wind down, Judge Cordell, I'd love you to react to something that the president said yesterday. He was speaking before the International Association for the Chiefs of Police Conference in Chicago, and he said the following. Listen.
I've told them to work with local authorities to try to change the terrible deal the city of Chicago entered into with ACLU, which ties law enforcement's hands, and to strongly consider stop and frisk. It works, and it was meant for problems like Chicago. It was meant for it. Stop and frisk.
President Trump speaking yesterday, and my apologies, he was speaking in Orlando, referring to Chicago. Judge Cordell, this keeps coming up often, and we don't have much time to spend on it, but could you just clarify for us what the law says about stop and frisk?
Sure. You know, the Trump administration, first of all, is hostile to any kind of oversight from the federal government over any law enforcement. So just put that out there. So stop and frisk, was deemed to be unconstitutional in New York. Basically, it gives officers the right to do just what it says, to stop people, to detain people, and then to frisk them for, you know, for reasons that don't rise up to what the legal standard is. And the notion was, look, if we can just stop and frisk people enough, then, you know, people are just not going to be inclined to commit any kind of crimes because they know we're watching them. And it had quite the opposite effect because it involved racial profiling. Stop and frisk basically is code for stop every black person, especially black male, that you see because they're likely up to no good. And in this way, we can really clamp down on everything. And that really creates the essence of an occupier in communities of color. So the Trump administration is hostile to any kind of restrictions on law enforcement, and the president himself has no clue about the things that he's talking. And Jeff Sessions, our attorney general, has basically said, I don't like this kind of federal oversight, and if they could, they would have undone the consent decree that came about in Chicago in working to try to bring some reform there.
Shannon, before we go, I know we're low on time, but I wonder what role you think this will have in how officers in Chicago engage with Chicagoans. Does this make things better, worse, or does this not really move the needle that much? Before we got to go.
Are you talking about the stop and frisk?
The conviction of Officer Van Dyke. Sorry.
I believe that it will force the city of Chicago to move forward at a much faster pace with better training and more transparency, because now they know that what they never thought would happen, being exposed, being caught, and being tried could happen again. I think they need to start better training for the officers. I do agree with both Judge Cordell and Major Franklin that the community needs to be involved. It needs to be less military-based and more community-friendly. Just to add to that, as far as officers being dropped into neighborhoods they're not familiar with, I am a white Irish female, blonde hair, blue eyes, and I was dropped into the Chicago Housing Projects, which was all African American. And if you are an officer that takes the oath to serve and protect everybody equally seriously, you can adapt. And officers must be able to adapt to every single community and be fair across the board. Mm-hmm. I was able to do it in one of the most dangerous neighborhoods in the nation. So officers need to remember, it doesn't have to be white people in white neighborhoods,
right,
or black and black. We all work together.
That's Chicago Police Officer Shannon Spaulding, Neil Franklin, Executive Director of Law Enforcement Against Prohibition, WBEZ's Patrick Smith, and retired Judge Ladoris Cordell. Everyone, thanks for talking to us. This show was produced by Morgan Givens. To learn more about him and the rest of our team, visit the1a.org/staff. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. I'm Joshua Johnson. Thanks for listening. This is 1A.